Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Welcome back, Sharkies, to Sharkpedia. Today we have Dr. Lauren Simonitis, the one and only. We've been wanting to get her on the podcast for a while and are so excited that she just dropped this incredible publication about olfactory rosettes and bonnet head sharks. So today we have Dr. Lauren Simonitis. Welcome, Dr. Simonitis.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a while.
Good.
Yay, new paper, ooh, shark noses, let's go.
Yeah, could you tell our sharkies a little bit about yourself and maybe your background and what you study?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Lauren. I was born in Miami. I went to school at the University of Miami for my bachelor's. And then I did my PhD at Texas A&M University at Galveston, which is the marine science campus. While I was there, I studied some different things about sensory biology. So I am an aquatic sensory biologist. So I was really interested in how animals use their senses underwater to interact with each other, to find food, but also how some animals can use defenses to attack these senses. So I studied a couple chemical defenses while I was during my PhD. And then part of that was like, we were looking at, okay, so how are these defenses attacking the sensory system of a predator? So then we started looking at shark olfaction and shark noses. And I was like, oh, we probably know a bunch about shark noses. Like, they're so popular. Everybody knows that they're nose-driven animals. They're like so smelly. And then I looked into the literature. We really don't really know that much. So I started really diving into shark nasal morphology and how they smell, what their noses look like, how water moves inside of their noses. So now I'm doing a postdoc at Friday Harbor Labs. And I'm also an NSF, National Science Foundation postdoc, postdoctoral fellowship, both at Friday Harbor and at Florida Atlantic University, where I am looking at shark noses.
Oh, that's incredible. I feel like we're going to do some debunking of noses today, too, because
yes,
I have some debunking questions for you for sure. Imani, do you want to break down, or do you want to introduce the article and break down the summary for us?
Absolutely. I would love to. So the article that we're going to be reading is Microstructure of the Bonnethead Shark Spherina tuberosa Olfactory Rosette. And the summary is, the weird shape of hammerhead sharks means that their nares or noses are also weirdly shaped. Previous research has shown that the flow of water in hammerhead noses has a complex structure that changes the pressure and therefore changes the velocity of water in the nose itself. Simonitis et al. Aim to describe the microstructure of the olfactory rosette of the bonnethead shark and investigate differences in the individual lamellae themselves within the rosette. Specifically, they looked at the degree of secondary folding, percent sensory area, and the relative surface area of the lamellae. This is the first time the olfactory nerve layer has been visually tracked through a shark lamella. They found that olfactory lamellae in areas of the olfactory organ that experience faster water flow have a larger percentage of sensory area and more secondary folds compared to those exposed to lower water velocities. Their findings imply that there may be less sensitive portions along the rosette. Future work should look at flow and sensitivity inside a shark's nose with this information in mind.
That's so cool. So we should just start, I think, with some background information for our listeners. How do sharks smell, and how is that different from a human nose?
Yeah, so sharks are passive smellers. So they, like, when we think about how we smell, we like sniff, like in, but our nose is connected to our respiratory system. So we can breathe through our nose. And when we breathe, we bring in air, which brings in chemicals. And then we have receptors in our nose that sense those chemicals and send that signal to our brain. Sharks breathe in through their mouth and then out through their gills for the most part. And that is separate from their noses. Their noses are these separate little chambers that are normally separated from their mouth. So when they're breathing, when they're forcing water through their mouth, either by swimming or by pumping, they are not pumping into their nose. So instead, they have two little nostrils or nares on either side of their face. And when they swim, water goes in through one of the nostrils called the incurrent nares and then out through the excurrent nares.
Amazing. I actually didn't really think about the fact that it wasn't connected to the respiratory system. That makes sense. Sharks don't have lungs, but I just never really thought about it until you said that.
Noses being connected to the respiratory system is something that we see if we look down the evolutionary line, we see that happen. If we think about snakes or other reptiles or amphibians that have what's called a Jacobson's organ, or in us, in mammals, a vomeronasal organ, which is the connection between your nose and your mouth. There's a little sensory organ back there that kind of connects the two, which is why our sense of smell and taste are so connected.
Oh my gosh. I have learned more about noses.
That's why I can't taste things. When I lose my
smell. Yeah, seriously. I've learned more about noses in these 2 minutes than I think I have my entire life.
That's my goal, man. Just evangelizing Lord. About noses.
Dr. Simonitis is the nose queen. So I just had a generic question, but are nose and nares interchangeable, or do they mean different things?
Yeah, so nares, it's kind of funny. I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, but naris, N-A-R-I-S, is the multiple, the two version or multiple version of nares, which is N-A-R-E-S. So it's Latin for nostril. So that's really what we're talking about when we say naris, is the nostril. That's just the anatomical term that is used across the board. But you can interchange naris and nostril, but nose, a nostril or a naris is part of a nose.
Got it. Okay. Because I realized as I was writing my fish class paper that I was like, I don't know the difference between these three things.
Oh, yeah. Our listeners.
Yeah, it is really funny.
Our listeners might not know this, but Amani just was in a class at Friday Harbor Labs with Dr. Simonitis. So they got to actually meet in person not too long ago.
Yeah. It was awesome.
I've been flipped to the nose side.
Yeah, Amani, I was so happy. Amani wanted to work on my nose project, and I was like, this is the best moment of my life.
Get more people excited about noses.
Okay. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's pretend we're going on a trip through a shark's nose. What sort of structures would we encounter, and how do they help with smell?
Yeah, of course. So first we have, like I was saying, the incurrent nostril. So this is where water, for the most part, is going to come into the nose. And that's how the water has all the chemicals in it, right? So that's all of the stuff that the shark is going to sense. So the water comes in through the incurrent nostril. It then goes into the incurrent chamber. This is just basically a little tube that runs into this giant structure we call the olfactory rosette. The olfactory rosette, it's named rosette because it looks like a little rose. And it's all of these rows and rows of little tissue called lamellae. So we see lamellae a lot of places. One of the places that you can think about the most is gills of a fish. So those are also lamellae. But these lamellae, they're kind of stacked together. I like to think of them as dishes in a dishwasher. So they're all these circular structures that are facing back to front, back to front. And water flows between them in the center of them. And then it turns around and comes back out the opposite way, going along the bottom of the lamellae, which goes through the excurrent chamber and then out through the excurrent nostril. And then in those lamellae are where the sensory structures sit. So here is where they're called olfactory receptor neurons, or ORNs. And these guys, they sit and they wait with their little receptor open for a chemical to come and bind. And when the chemical binds, they send an electrical signal, which is called an action potential, which carries that information saying, hey, I've just bound to this chemical. This chemical is in the water. We're smelling this chemical. And that signal goes up through the lamellae, up through the olfactory nerve layer, into the olfactory bulb. In the olfactory bulb, it like gets communicated up into the olfactory peduncle or the olfactory tract. There's a lot of names for like the same structure because people like discovered it at the same time and named it different things. But the olfactory tract brings it up into the brain or the telencephalon, which is the forebrain, where the shark then processes that information and decides what it's going to do about that.
Telencephalon is a really fun word to say.
Yeah, I agree.
That's amazing. Yeah, that was a really good like description. I definitely felt like I was on Magic School Bus and shrunk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always picture like the Magic School Bus whenever I describe it, because it's like, if I'm in a little bus with Miss Frizzle, like how would I journey through the nose?
Who do we have to talk to get a shark nose Miss Frizzle episode?
I don't know, but we need to get in contact with them immediately.
Immediately, because that would be sick. That would be so cool.
Do they even
still
make that show?
I know that they like brought it back with like Kate McKinnon as Miss Frizzle. Yeah.
What?
At Kate McKinnon, can we do a shark nose adventure, please? And thank you. If anyone who's listening knows Kate McKinnon, let us know.
We have an idea for you.
Yeah, we sure do. So that was a really great little trip that we just took through shark snows. Now, specifically, your study species was the bonnethead. What is a bonnethead?
Oh, they're just the cutest little babies. That's the answer.
I love them.
So bonnetheads are a hammerhead. They're a type of hammerhead. There are multiple species of hammerhead. They are like one of the smallest. They're only like the ones I worked with are about like 3 feet. Maybe 4 feet on a good day. They were so small and cute and adorable. And instead of like the typical hammer shape that we think of, they have more of a shovel. So some places they're called the shovel nose shark as well.
They're so cute.
They're my favorite shark, in case anyone is wondering. They're the best.
They're my favorite.
I think they're my second favorite. I have to put Sevengill first, but oh my gosh, those bonnet heads are a very close, almost tie. So what separates hammerhead noses from other shark noses?
Yeah, so just like sharks are really, really different, right? So we have sharks that live in really warm temperatures, really cold temperatures, different depths, different environments. They're open ocean, they're coral reef inhabiting, they're like in rivers sometimes. So just like sharks are super different, their heads are really different, and their noses are super different. So since hammerheads have these giant cephalofoils, that's what we call their hammerhead. They have this huge area, which is mostly taken up by a nose. So it's like, if you look at the whole thing, I would say if you looked at the entire like head, probably like close to 50% of it is taken up by these giant olfactory rosettes. And they're really long and like a tube. And that's kind of that pathway I described of like the water coming in, going to the end, turning around and coming back out. That is really, really well exemplified in hammerhead organs because they're so long, so tubular. A lot of the other, like if we think of like carcharinids, so like sharks that are more like pointy headed, like what we think of like a normal shark, a lot of them have a more of a bulb type structure. So it looks less like a tube, more like a ball. And then we have some that are like intermediate. So they're kind of between a long cylinder and like a ball. So hammerheads have like just the longest tubes. And then like they're kind of like the end of that spectrum of like tube to ball.
I love that description so much.
Me too. So they have these really long tube noses. Do they have any advantages over other species because of their different nose morphology?
Yeah, that is a really great question. And that's something that people have been trying to figure out for a while now. So everybody kind of just said, oh, yeah, they have giant noses, must be great smellers. But actually, the scientists that I work with at Florida Atlantic University, Drs. Steve Kajura and Tricia Meredith, during Tricia's PhD, she looked at basically testing this. So like, do sharks with different olfactory morphologies, do they actually have advantages? Like if they have bigger noses, if they have more lamellae, if they have bigger olfactory bulbs, like do they smell better? And the truth is that no. Basically, all of the sharks that she tested for olfactory sensitivity, so it's a really cool test. Basically, you put a little electrode outside of their nostril, like right above like where the sensory structures start. And because you're in salt water, you can, and it's super conductive, the electrode can pick up the summation of all the action potentials. So those little electrical signals that the little olfactory receptors say to the brain, ping, like, ping, hey, we're smelling something. Ping. You can, exactly. It's all these little pings that are all coming together in this big, like, signal. So, like, kind of like when you're hooked up to an EKG and you can see, like, your little heartbeat, like the electrical signal of your heart, we can see the electrical signal of the nose. So whenever we pipette on, like, an amino acid or another sensory stimuli, we see, like, a little, like, uptick and, like, oh, they're smelling something. So she looked at, like, what concentrations of amino acids that they can smell. And basically she saw that across the board, there's not really a difference in, like, how sensitive they are to different amino acids. And the big bummer, I think, for a lot of people is that it's actually the same sensitivity as most bony fish, so most non-sharky fish. So sharks are really, like, not these super crazy, super good smellers compared to other fish. It's still, like, a really, really good sensitivity. Like, they're really good, but they're not better than their, like, bony cousins.
So they can't smell blood from a mile away. Should we just, like, debunk that right now?
Yeah, like, so there's a lot of things that go into that. Because, like, I guess, like, they could if it's – so they can smell down to the 10 to the negative 9 mole per liter. That's, like, their sensitivity range. So it's pretty – it's a lot. So they probably could smell, like, a drop of blood, but it would depend on – like, there's a lot of things that go on in that, right? Because you have to have, like – if you have no water movement and there's just, like, a drop of blood in the water, like, it's going to diffuse kind of slowly. Like, if you've ever, like, dropped dye in water and you watch it, like, slowly move. So, yeah, they could sense that if it got to them eventually – or if, like, water current is moving it to them, then they could smell it faster. So it's more about depending on, like, concentration versus, like, flow of water rather than, like, just a drop of blood in the water.
Thank you. I love that.
Yeah.
So your objectives were to, one, describe the microstructures of the olfactory rosette, and two, to look at individual lamellae based on their positioning within the rosette. Did you have any initial hypotheses about either of these objectives, and what were those?
Yeah, so for describing the microstructure, luckily there is a lot of recent work done by a couple of really good scientists like Sarah Ferrando and Victoria Schlussel, who have published really good olfactory morphology papers on a bunch of sharks. Bonnet heads were missing from, like, this giant pool of what sharks we've looked at. There was one other hammerhead that was looked at, so I was thinking we'd probably see something similar to this other hammerhead. But I was just like, I'm sure that'll follow the general pattern of other sharks, which is, like, rosettes. In the rosettes, there's two lamellae attached to the olfactory bulb, and then there's non-sensory and sensory epithelium. So that was my prediction. That is what we saw. So that was pretty cool. And then for the other question, so there was a paper that I bring up in my paper that looked at how flow differs inside of these long tubular organs. They looked at a small eye hammerhead, which is very similar to a bonnet head. And they found that, like, basically as water is moving throughout this organ, it flows differentially. So there's some places where the velocity is super high. There's some places where it's super low. Actually, in the paper, they called it, like, a near stagnant recirculating area in, like, the closest, like, to the center part of the nose. So I thought, yeah, there had to be there must be differences in sensory morphology as we move along that gradient, because it would be very interesting if they had the same ability, like, the same amount of sensitivity despite how water was flowing within the organ.
So cool. I think I tweeted this the other day, but I was like, I say cool so much on this podcast, I need help.
I say amazing.
You talk about such cool
things. Yeah.
So generally when we think about doing dissections on sharks, we kind of think of the more, like, large organs and the body cavity. Why is it important to pay attention to the nose and study it?
Well, because sensory organs are the best. So that's the real answer to that.
Love that answer.
But also, it's just like, thank you. It's just like, it's so interesting to see, like, the variation of morphologies in all of these, like, sensory organs. So specifically the nose is, like, just so different between sharks. It's also just, you know, that's at the front of their head. It is, like, one of the first things that they use when they're trying to find prey. Also, in, like, the aquatic environment, olfaction, so chemical stimuli coming into the nose, is one of the most long-range sensory systems. So if we compare it to like electrosensory stuff, which sharks are very famous for, but that has to be really, really close range, right? They can't sense an electrical signal super far away. If we think about vision, you know, it's dark sometimes. Sometimes the waves are choppy and there's sediment, so that's usually impaired. Hearing is also pretty far, but that just depends on like what's around them. But sensing smells is something that they can do from really, really long range. So it is one of their first windows into their world, is like their nose. It's one of the first things that they can use.
They see with their nose.
Smell. Smelling time.
Yeah.
I don't know why that came out like that.
I love it.
I love it.
So you had some different methods to study your hypotheses. We're going to go over a couple of those. First, can you describe to us what light micrographs are and how you use those?
Yeah, so that's a really fancy way of just describing like what we think of all the time when we think about looking through a microscope. So a bunch of people, I'm sure, in their biology classes or if they've ever gone to like a museum outreach event or something like that, they have looked through a microscope and looked at something that is on a slide. And that's what that is. So we are looking at something through a microscope where we shine light at it either from above or below. We look through little objectives, or we attach a camera to the top and we can take pictures. But yeah, it's just shining light through a specimen. Mine specifically, I process them through something called histology. So histology is like a really, really, really old technique that exists in science. And it has persisted because it is so useful. So essentially, I put my noses in this like hard paraffin wax block. So I take out anything that is soft and then I infuse it with paraffin so I can get it nice and thick and strong so that I can put it on this like essentially a very, very fine deli meat slicer. And then I cut them into these tiny thin sections that are about between like 7 to 5 microns, so micrometers. And that gives me about like an individual cell layer. So I'm basically cutting an individual cell layer each time. And then I put that on a slide, I dry it, I stain it, and I can see all of the different cells, like they look differently depending on like how much of the stain they take up or what types of stain they take up. And then I put that on my microscope and I use light micrography to look at the cell structures.
Awesome. I love the mini deli meat slicer. I have used a cryostat before. That's what they're called, to look at octopus tissue. And it's seriously one of my like favorite lab techniques. I could slice tissue all day. It's so fun.
I love histology so much. And I love like paraffin.
What a bunch of nerds. Oh my gosh.
I know. I love paraffin histology because you're just playing with like hot wax all day. So like it's kind of like when you were little, like I don't know if anybody else was like this kind of a child, but you put like the glue on your hands and then you peel it off.
Oh my gosh,
like,
yes.
I do that like constantly for fun. I'm just like, ooh, wax. I can peel it off my
skin. Oh my gosh. That's
amazing.
Fun. Yeah, I haven't used the paraffin wax before. I've used the like cryo molds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Yeah. So the other method that you used is scanning electron microscopy. Can you explain what that is to the best of your ability?
Yeah, for sure. So the best of my ability is the key word here, because the SEM, I love using it. So we abbreviated SEM. But it's one of my favorite things to use. But I'm always scared to like whenever it breaks, I'm like, I don't really fully understand like what's going on here. But basically what we do is the first thing is that this is done under vacuum. So we have to get all of the moisture out of our sample, which is really easy if you're studying something like Imani was looking at denticles. So they're hard. They're hard structures. So it's you basically just leave them out in the sun and they dry off and then you can proceed. But with something squishy and mucousy, like a nose, we have to do a lot of things to pull out all the moisture. So we take it through all of these procedures. I'm not going to go through all of them, to take out as much moisture as possible. And then we sputter coat them. So we put them into this machine, which uses argon gas. And we use gold palladium. Some people use platinum, but you use some sort of metal to sputter the entire top of whatever you're looking at. So basically now it's like covered in this like little shiny material. And then you put it into the SEM, which goes down under vacuum, and then it shoots electrons onto whatever your specimen is, and they get scattered differentially. So basically, you get kind of like this topographic map, so like with different elevations and such, of areas of light and dark that show you this really, really high resolution image of what you're looking at. So you can look at the surface of whatever you are putting in there, because it's covered with this shiny material and you're bouncing electrons off of it differentially.
It's so much fun. I obsessed over this when I was doing this on my little noses. I think I sat in the room with the SEM for like 6 hours straight, just taking all these really pretty photos of denticles. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it is. Like, you can get lost. Like, I've really gotten lost on the SEM. Like, I always have to remind myself, like, okay, I'm here with a purpose. We can't just like look at everything like for hours. If you've seen like these like really, really high def black and white images of like the surface of something, it is almost always an SEM. Wow.
Oh, that's so cool. I have not done it, but I want to really bad.
Come to the SEM side.
So you were looking at sensory epithelium within sharks. What is sensory versus non-sensory epithelium?
That is a good question. So epithelium just is like the term we use for like the outermost layer of like skin or like tissue that is covering something. So like our epithelium is like the top of our skin. Or if we think about like the alimentary epithelium, that is like what covers like our alimentary canal or our digestive epithelium. Noses are the same. They have a epithelium covering these different parts of the lamellae. And there is sensory and non-sensory. So non-sensory is kind of where there's a bunch of mucus cells on there. So they produce mucus. They also like kind of provide the structure. And then if we look into the sensory epithelium, that is where all of those olfactory receptors sit. And we can't always see the olfactory receptors because they are like surrounded by these fields of cilia. So like these little hair-like projections. Because all around the sensory cells are these non-sensory supporting cells that are covered in cilia. So it's basically, it just looks like a field of little hairs. And I always think it looks like forbidden spaghetti is like how I always describe it.
Forbidden
spaghetti. Yeah, and hammerheads specifically, they are super dense. Like it is just a field of cilia. It's awesome.
Major forbidden spaghetti. Uh-huh. Amazing. So during these methods, you said that some of your specimens shrunk. How do you account for that shrinkage when you go back and you want to analyze those specimens?
Yeah. So one of the things that I did was I basically compared, instead of looking at how much they shrunk, like looking at their area and these morphometrics after they shrunk, I compared them within the organ that had all been treated the same way to the largest organ, lamellae. So everything was a percentage of the largest lamellae rather than just like the true size of that lamellae.
Yeah, that makes sense. Specifically, you looked at secondary folding, percent sensory area, and relative surface area. Can you kind of break down what each of those are?
Yeah. So I'll actually start with the percent sensory area. So that is what I was just talking about, which is the non-sensory epithelium versus the sensory epithelium. So if I look at the total area of the entire lamellae, what percentage of it is taken up by these fields of cilia, the sensory epithelium? And then secondary folding kind of goes on top of that because lamellae and sharks, they have these secondary folds. Also some non-sharky fish. So some teleosts have it too. But basically these are these like folds within the olfactory organ that increase surface area, right? So instead of just having something flat that takes up the same amount of space, if you like accordion it in, you're fitting in more surface area into the same amount of space. So both of those serve as like proxies for how much area is devoted to sensitivity within that structure. And then the total relative surface area was kind of what I was just saying as well, is like instead of looking at that surface area, since it's shrunk because of all those dehydrations we have to do. So we look at like how big each lamellae is compared to the biggest lamellae.
Awesome.
Why were these the like specific things that you wanted to look at?
Right. So I was looking at basically like how these lamellae were different within that like medial to lateral gradient. So when I say that, I mean like lateral is the lamellae closest to the edge of the nose, so closest to the nostrils. And then medial are the ones closest to the center of the head. And because we saw different flows, I was like, okay, if water is moving faster here and slower here, do they have different amounts of sensors to like basically pick up chemicals when they're moving differently? And we can't really right now get good counts of olfactory receptors. A bunch of people are working on it. That's kind of like what I'm trying to do now. But it's pretty intensive. So this was just kind of like the first step of like, okay, do the morphologies change? And then these two things, so sensory folding and percent surface area, percent sensory area, are kind of like proxies for sensitivity. So if they have more area that is devoted to sensitivity, we can maybe say that these parts are more sensitive.
But until you measure the olfactory neurons, you can't actually say that for sure. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So this is kind of just like a proxy, but like we really do need to, one, actually measure how many receptors are there, and two, actually test the sensitivity. So we've talked about like basically opening up the capsule and like doing those olfactory electroolfactograms, what I was talking about with the little electrode, at different parts of the capsule and seeing if they're actually differently sensitive. But I will say that using like receptor count or sensory morphology as a proxy for sensitivity, so saying like, okay, if the neurons are bigger here, if there is more sensitive area here, this is probably more sensitive, is something that we use a ton in like neurobiology. Because a lot of times, like especially like if your specimens are not preserved like absolutely perfectly, the first thing that dies when an animal dies is its nervous system, like especially these olfactory receptors, because they're sitting out in the water, right? These are the only really receptors that directly touch the external environment. So as soon as they die, they like shrivel up. So whenever I get my specimens that weren't exactly preserved immediately after they died, because I got a lot of specimens from like fishermen who are like, hey, I caught this shark, can I give it to you? I'd be like, sure, of course, my pleasure. What I see instead of seeing those like receptors is I see pockets. Oh. Where like I think that there was a receptor. It's just a hole, but they're dead. So I can't like confirm that that actually was a receptor.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So before we go into our results, I kind of just wanted to orient us a little bit in the nose. So you numbered your lamellae from 1 to 60. Is 1 at like the entrance of the nose and 60 is towards the back?
Yes. So 1 okay. is at like the nostril and then 60 is like medial, like towards the center of the nose.
Okay.
End of the
wonderful. Day. Yeah. Amazing. Great.
Yeah.
So let's move on then. So what does a bonnethead olfactory rosette actually look like? Is there anything that makes it unique from other noses that you've looked at?
Yeah. It's pretty standard. So it is connected at the top to the bulb. It is connected on something we call a raphe. So it's like, or rafe. People call it different things depending on like who told you that word first. But that's like kind of like the central structure. And then you have two paired lamellae that come off of it with that secondary fold. And then you have the non-sensory epithelium located in the center. So like more towards like the hole in the middle. And then if you move outwards towards the end of the lamellae, that's where the sensory epithelium is. So it's pretty typical if you think about most sharks.
Awesome. And then you talk about in your results the olfactory nerve. And is the olfactory nerve in a shark similar or the same when we consider nerves in people?
Yeah. So in all, I won't say, like all mammals, we have like conserved cranial nerves, which is like cranial nerves 1 through 12. So if anybody's taken like a neurobiology class, like you have to memorize them. And everybody has different ways that you memorize these nerves. But the first cranial nerve 1 is the olfactory nerve. And we see that in mammals. We also see it in most other vertebrates. So the olfactory nerve is essentially the pathway between the brain to where the receptors in the nose are. But in sharks, it's a little bit different because if we think about our olfactory bulb is actually part of our brain. So we have like these little like areas in the front of our brain, which are the olfactory bulbs. In sharks, they are still part of the brain, but they exist like really far down. So they're actually down by the nostril and they're connected by this really long part of the olfactory nerve, which is called the olfactory tract or the olfactory peduncle. And it's this really long tube of nerves that travels between the telencephalon, the forebrain, and the olfactory bulb. But that is technically part of the brain.
Huh. They have like an extension of their brain. Kind of.
Yeah, it's really funny.
That is really cool.
Yeah, that whole area is cranial nerve one. And then just to really like throw a wrench in everything is that sharks and some fish also have another cranial nerve, which isn't in mammals. So it's called cranial nerve zero. Huh. And it's called the terminal nerve. And it goes like on the underside of the brain and then like connects to the nose too. But we really don't understand like how that thing works. So we're just like, it's there. Now let's focus on the one we know.
Oh my gosh.
Great. Thanks, sharks. Just another thing that we have no idea what the heck it is.
Mm-hmm. So shark brains then, are they not like round like we would think in mammals? Do they have a bunch of projections, or is that primarily just the olfactory nerve that's kind of projecting out from it?
Yeah, so the olfactory bulb is like the most dramatic projection. And I will say that in hammerheads, it is very, very dramatic. So like that really long olfactory bulb connected by that really long olfactory tract is pretty dramatic. Some other sharks, like if we think about spiny dogfish, or if we think about other sharks, it is closer. It is not like that dramatic of a separation. And we see this in fish too. So there are some fish that have like a pretty big separation in that bulb. But if you look at the rest of the brain, instead of it all being condensed into like this little blob, instead it's kind of like three-ish blobs with like a little trunk off the back. It's this like highly segmented brain.
Oh, that's so cool. I don't think I ever actually thought about what a shark brain looks like.
Yeah, basically, like, as you, like, move, like, phylogenetically, like, if you think about, like, fish and then, like, amphibians and reptiles and mammals, like, our brains get, like, less and less segmented and more conserved into, like, what we think about when we see our brain.
Oh, so cool.
This is kind of weird, but the first time I saw a shark brain, I kind of thought it looked like a Christmas tree ornament.
That is funny, because I said this before we started the podcast, but I used to have a model of like the olfactory, like the whole olfactory bulb and the brain sitting on my desk of a spiny dogfish, because I used it for teaching and I was like, ooh, this is cool. And I just had it on my desk full time, but it looks like ovaries and a fallopian tube and like a vagina and a uterus. Like it looks like the female reproductive system. So people would come by my desk and be like, why do you have like a uterus on your desk? And I was like, no, it's brain and nose.
Oh my god, I love that so much.
Oops.
Amazing.
So you found that lamellae 1 through 5 and 56 through 60 had shorter surface areas. Why do you think this might be?
Yeah, so are you talking, the total surface area?
Yeah.
Sorry. Right. So yes. No, you're totally fine. There's two surface areas. And even I, like when I was writing, I like got confused. I was like, wait, which one am I talking about right now? So if I look at total surface area, so how big the lamellae are compared to each other, at those two extremes, they're smaller. And it's like, if you look at them, they're like, also they like curve inwards. They like create this, like most of the lamellae are like stacked up and down. But then when you get to the ends, they kind of like curve upwards. So they're much, much, much smaller, which meant that they were a pain to take out as well when I was trying to look at them. So it's just kind of like the structure of them. I don't really know a reason why, but those are also the areas where the flow is the slowest. So in my brain, I've kind of been like, okay, like these are areas that aren't getting hit with as much force of the water coming in so fast. So they can be a little bit more delicate and a little bit smaller.
If the ones closest to the entrance of the nose are like curved in, I guess, towards the rest of the rosette, do you think that it's possible that when they're born, it's like stacked straight up and down like books, but then because water is always flowing in, it's like it makes the lamellae kind of fall over?
Possibly. I will let you know, because I actually am looking at the olfactory morphology of some sharks that haven't been born yet. So I'll let you know how it looks with like a fetal shark versus a adult shark.
Oh, so that's so
I'll
cool.
Let you know. Stay tuned.
Oh my gosh.
Find out next yes. time.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so that was surface area. So you found that sensory area was pretty consistent throughout the rosette, except on the medial lamellae. So lamellae numbers 56 through 60. Why do you think that might be?
Yeah. So that was really, really fun. Like when I found that, I was like, oh yes, this is awesome. Because that corresponds with what the other paper from Rigg et al. In 2019 found for an area of low recirculating flow. So this is that area where like water is really, really slow. It's almost stagnant and it's recirculating. So if those chemicals get there, they're moving pretty slowly. And that is the area where they have less sensitivity, well, less like sensitive area. So in my head, when I was reasoning this out, I was like, okay, like if water is moving really, really fast past a part of the nose, you want to expand the amount of sensors that are waiting there to catch it. So you have really, really high sensory area to have all the chances to catch those water molecules, those chemicals. But then when you get to the slower parts of the nose, you have like, it's moving slower, it's kind of recirculating. So you have multiple chances. So you're not going to put all of that energy into making all these little sensory receptors there, because if it's moving slow and it's recirculating, you can kind of just not have as many there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I'm fascinated. It's so cool. So in your discussion, you kind of talk about these microvillus and crypto-ORNs. What is that? Why is that a thing that you were like, I should include this in my paper?
So one of the biggest things that's interesting about sharks is that teleosts, so bony fish, they have microvillus and crypto-ORNs, so olfactory receptor neurons, but they also have ciliated olfactory receptor neurons. And that just is like three different types of olfactory receptor neurons. And they are supposed to bind differentially to different chemicals. So basically, it's kind of like this like lock and key fit that we talk about when we talk about receptors. So a certain chemical binds to a certain type of receptor. So they respond specifically to different types of chemicals. So basically, if you think about ciliated olfactory receptor neurons, they are normally tied in bony fish to bile salts, which are like basically a way that they can communicate between themselves. And when Trisha, Dr. Meredith, who I work with at FAU, when she, during her PhD, tested, can sharks still respond to bile salts, even though they don't have ciliated receptor neurons, they can. So it's kind of like, okay, well, what receptor neurons are doing this in sharks then? Because we don't have the ones that are supposed to respond to this. So that's kind of like why I included it, just because it's like one of the coolest things about sharks to me is that like they're missing an entire class of receptor neurons, yet they're just as sensitive and they still respond to the thing that they're not supposed to be able to respond to.
Oh my gosh, that is actually really cool. Yeah. This is kind of a little bit aside, but I also wondered when I was reading the paper, you talk about how some of the cilia move mucus, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but for me, it was hard to kind of imagine sharks doing that, I guess, because they're in salt water. And so I would think if they're producing mucus, it would just like flush off of them because they're swimming through water. Do you know how they actually keep that mucus on their skin?
Yeah, it's like, so this is like inside of the nose. So the water flows are significantly less than like what's going over the rest of the body. Oh, so they're not sloughing off as far, but they also produce a ton of mucus. Like they have these mucus cells literally like covering that non-sensory epithelium. They are very prevalent. And like the amount of mucus I see when I am looking at my samples is astronomical. Like it's just like everywhere. But mucus is great because it overcomes this barrier, right? So like if you have water, you have like water flowing really quickly, mucus can trap the chemicals and then bring it to the receptors. Oh, so sure. Instead of like having just like randomly catching them, they don't really catch things, but like waiting for water to flow into you. Instead, if you have a layer of mucus over you, like the mucus catches the chemical and then you can like easily grab the chemical as a little receptor neuron.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
I also like, as an aside, the tiger sharks, that they'll be slimy in the water. Like they're definitely not. Yeah. They have like what I would consider to be mucus just like sitting on the outside of their body, which is kind of weird because it would be covering the denticles to some extent. And so I haven't really been able to find that many papers on the like actual mucus that sharks secrete on their bodies, but I'm just like curious about why.
I was going to say, and like why some sharks are more mucousy than others. Like we need a mucus specialist.
Yeah. You know, it's not about sharks, but I remember that I know Dylan Wainwright was looking at this during his PhD with George Lauder. Like he was looking at how different mucuses work with the scales of different fish and like teleost fish. But you should look. I don't know if he's published that yet. I remember he presented it at a SICB and it was really cool. But yeah. I feel like everything has to be done on bony fish first. They're like, let's look at these guys before we look at the fun ones.
Let's get the boring out of the way. So this is the first time that the olfactory nerve layer was visually tracked through the shark lamella. What is the importance of filling this knowledge gap?
Yeah, so this is something that we think about a lot when we think about sharks, especially compared to mammals. So there's kind of always this perception that like mammal brains are the best. And one of the biggest things is that mammals form somatotopic maps, which means basically in the brain, when it processes signals from different parts of the body, like your brain knows if you are being stimulated on your hand versus like your arm or whatever. So that's like kind of like this touch receptor somatotopic map that we have in our brains. But what's really cool about sharks and about fish is that we're seeing that in some fish that we've been studying, they have a somatic topic map of their noses. So again, I keep bringing up Dr. Tricia Meredith, but like she like has done a lot of this work. So she saw that like basically in the bonnet heads, the parts like the lamellae project directly above them into the bulb. Like if you put dye on like the receptors in like the lateral lamellae, they project to the lateral half of the bulb. And if like that organization like continues up into the brain, that means that a shark can tell like, oh, I sensed it on this part of my nose, which is like where that slow moving current is. So like that could give them some information about like the concentration of the chemicals that are coming. So like that's pretty cool. And then so that's kind of like this one order of like basically receptor to bulb. And then what I saw, and I saw this like accidentally, essentially, like I was just like sectioning my lamellae and then I was like looking at them and I was like, oh my gosh, like I can see the projections of the olfactory receptors to the bulb, like how those olfactory receptors sent their axons to the olfactory bulb. So I was like, oh, I should just mention this because it's pretty cool. I like to describe it as like, I haven't quite figured out like who is talking to where yet. So instead of like mapping, I basically mapped the highway of information. So like, this is where the cars could go, but I don't know which car goes where yet. That's kind of like the next step. And when I talked about stains, you can do like differential stains. So like you can stain for something specific and you can also like stain certain areas. But I was just doing a general stain. So I can't say anything else about like the specificity of where these nerves are going. But I can say that these are where they are generally moving. So it's kind of like groundwork level stuff.
So cool. So you know how like when we smell coffee, we can't really tell what direction it's coming from? Can sharks tell what direction a smell is coming from?
So that is something that is really, really cool in that especially hammerheads, this is kind of like one of the hypotheses for like why hammerheads have these like really big like olfactory receptors, like, and then these olfactory rosettes, and they're really far spaced apart nostrils, is that they can do what is called kinetaxis. So they can tell like where chemicals are coming from. So like if they hit one side of their face first, they will like turn to that side. And there's actually a study that was done a while ago. It's by Johnson and Teeter, and they did it on bonnet heads where they put these little head mounts on them, and they put little pipettes like into their nose, and they like basically would pipe into like one nostril at a time, and whatever nostril they piped into, the shark would turn that way because it was like, ooh, I'm smelling stuff this way.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
And then like further work by Jane Gardner, she did this too, where she was looking at basically how the lateral line, so how sharks sense movement of water correlates with their sense of smell. And they used both of those things together to kind of orient into odor plumes or like wherever the odor is coming from in like however it's being traveled in the water.
That is so cool. Yeah. I love the description of odor plume. I'm just like imagining a shark go into a cloud of smell.
That's what they do. They like will really just like go like balls to the wall into that smell and be like, hell yeah, I'm investigating it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Is there sharks? Is there like a maximum or minimum lamellae or sensory surface that you think they need to have to like optimally smell something?
Well, yeah, no, because no matter like what they're like, there's some sharks that have been tested with very few lamellae. There's some with like a lot of lamellae, like these hammerheads, and they all have like similar sensitivities as far as we can tell. So that's one of the things that I think is important in like my paper when I looked at sensory area versus non-sensory area, because previous papers have just looked at overall area. So like how much area does the lamellae take up as a whole, or like how many lamellae are there? So I think that the differences must be in like how many receptors are in each area. I also in the paper I say that like I think that we need to look along this gradient. Like we can't just think about sensitivity from the one place we record, because that is just like one level of morphology, right? Because we see differences within that nose. So if we record from different areas and especially at different flow rates, like do we see differences?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say the flow rate would definitely be interesting. Have they looked at that between species, like the flow rate over the – no.
The answer is no.
We did it once on one – they did one study once on a hammerhead, and they were like, sounds good. This is the flow rate. And so now people are, like, getting into it. It's just, like, really difficult. Like, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And then, like, that root paper that I, like, referenced is, like, one of the few, like, really, like, in-depth studies into one, and it's on the small eye hammerhead, and like that's all we have.
Wow, you guys, there's so much research to do still.
Help.
It's so honestly, I need more people on Team Nose. That's why I'm actively recruiting. I'm like, I need help. I can't do this by myself.
Do you hear that, guys? Become Team Nose.
Team Nose.
Yes, please.
So is there anything that we didn't cover that you think we should touch on before we wrap up?
No, I think you guys did a pretty good job. I mean, you guys were real thorough, so I appreciated it. Yeah, no, I can't really think of anything.
Okay, so now is our favorite part of the podcast, where we ask what your favorite field story is, which can be in the field or the lab or otherwise, just a story that you would maybe not be able to tell otherwise.
Yeah, so I don't know. I've had, like, I did a lot of, like, lab work for the most part, so I am very much, like, a lab scientist, but I had to do field work to get my sharks. So one of the hardest things for field work was, basically, I was starting a part of my project, and I started experiments in March of 2020, so those...
Oh, my gosh.
But I still needed to collect sharks, and I was, like, trying to make this thing work, essentially, like, in the pandemic. And we, like, weren't allowed to go into the field to begin with, but then we were allowed to go into the field, but with, like, no interns and no undergrad interns, which is how, like, it was really hard to go by yourself. It's actually pretty dangerous to go into the field alone a lot of times. So what was really awesome is the community of Galveston, Texas, like the fishers there, they were amazing. And like, I basically put up flyers. Like, it was so embarrassing. I put up flyers of like my picture and be like, if you catch a shark, like a bonnet head, and it's alive and you want to call this like PhD student, like, here's my number, and like a little picture of myself, like to prove that I wasn't like weirdo. And then I just had like a shark like transportation system where it was just like a tank with like oxygen in the back of a truck, and I would just like wait at all hours. Like, I had my phone on loud all day, and then like if a fisherman called me, I'd be like, I'm on my way, and I would like hop, I would like go to school, hop in my little like shark transport thing, and like drive it over to wherever they were. It was chaotic, but it was like so nice that like the community was so willing to help me, like when I wasn't able to go out and collect like the way I normally am. So I love that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and I think it's a great way to show too that like it's so important for like if you're working in a community to like reach out to the people that are actively fishing all the time, because like they are so willing to help if they like know what you're doing, and if you like respect them and are like really like you value their expertise and like their ability to fish, like it's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. We love sharing that narrative of working well with others, and especially the fishers that are on the water every single day.
Yeah.
Couldn't do this science without them.
No way. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Simonides, thank you so much for being here today. We really enjoyed it. I learned so much about shark noses. I had no idea how much I didn't know about noses. This is so cool. I cannot wait to follow more of your work.
Yes.
Where can I and other listeners follow you and keep up to date on all of your research?
Yeah, for sure. So I am on Twitter and I'm on Instagram at Ocean Explorin. Like the end of Explorin is like L-A-U-R-E-N, like my name. So you can find me there on both. I also love to plug MISS, so Minorities in Shark Science. We do a lot of work. I do a lot of work with them, and a lot of my stuff is featured on their socials as well, so pretty easy to find. And also, my last name is super, like, individual, Simonitis, so all you gotta do is, like, Google my name and all my things will come up. I'm, like, the only one.
Amazing. Yeah, we'll make sure to put that in the show notes so our Sharky listeners can find you.
Yay. Yeah, it was so much fun. I had such a great time talking to you guys today. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. All right, Sharkies, until next time.
Swim you later.
Awesome.
Dance party. Who needs an outro song when we